Hello and welcome to the TES News Podcast. I'm Catherine Love, reporter at TES, and joining me today is Mary Louise Clues, Deputy News Editor. Hi, Mary.
Hi there.
And we've also got reporter John Roberts. Hi, John.
Hello there.
And reporter Amy Gibbons. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
So this week we have seen a range of announcements from controversial plans for teacher training to updates on coronavirus safety in schools. We also heard from the incoming Ofqual chief regulator, Jo Saxton, about her preferences for 2022 exams. So firstly, the government announced a major shakeup of teacher training on Monday after its major teacher training review, including how all providers will need to go through a rigorous reaccreditation process. Amy, you've reported on this. What has the reaction been from providers about this announcement?
Well, it's been extremely controversial, as you've sort of touched on there, for reasons everybody can probably imagine. I mean, all providers being told that they're going to have to go through a process of reaccreditation is really unsettling for them, understandably. So, yes, from the sector itself, the backlash has been very, very strong already. So this report that came out from the ITT review group, the proposals that are in the report are now subject to consultation for 7 weeks. So people are going to have a chance to express some of their concerns then. But we've already had people such as the National Association for School-Based Teacher Trainers, NASBIT, the head of that association, Emma Hollis, spoke out about how she's particularly worried about the timeline recommended for the changes. So not only are teacher trainers having to worry about getting reaccredited, but I kind of want to specify here that the timeline itself didn't come from the review group. That's actually something that's come from the DfE. So the review group said, they recommended the review reaccreditation process, and the DfE have put a time frame on it, which has not gone down well. Essentially, it means that those changes have to happen. Reaccreditation has to happen by September 2022, which is not a lot of time for people to get their bids together, decide what they're going to do, and get through the whole process itself. So I'd say that's possibly, I mean, it's all very controversial, but that's possibly been the most controversial thing, has been the idea of how quickly all of this has to happen at a time when it's already, there's an awful lot of disruption going on in the sector. I mean, do they really need, is this really the best time to be making these changes? People will be asking that.
I mean, I saw some really strong wording around this from not only Emma Hollis, but I think Nick Brook from the NHT also sort of described it as a sledgehammer approach and unnecessary. And the other thing is, we haven't been told yet, have we, who decides who's accredited or not? So have providers also asked about that? Like, just the fact that we don't really know who is going to be overseeing this accreditation process?
Absolutely. There's still quite a lot of unknowns floating around. I suppose when something's in a consultation phase, the department can say, look, we'll take suggestions and then we'll make clarifications down the line. And that's what they told me when I asked them who would be running the reaccreditation process. I mean, lots of people would argue that's quite an important detail, wouldn't they? Because if you're deciding whether to go through a process where the selection will be made by the DfE versus Ofsted versus an independent external, contracted provider, it's that will influence your decision, and it'll influence kind of how you go about your bid. So I think that's something that we don't have an answer on at the moment. You're right that Mr. Brook from the NAHT was not particularly pleased, you might say, a bit of an understatement, with the proposals. He did describe it as like putting a sledgehammer to the sector, and he's worried about how it will impact on the supply of teachers down the road. There's kind of concerns that this will end up actually cutting teacher supply, which is not what we want, given that only a couple of years ago, I mean, only just over a year ago, really, we were very concerned about future supply of teachers, and we had the recruitment crisis going on. So, it's certainly a lot of concern surrounding that. I think people were expecting to be unhappy with the proposals, because from the beginning, lots of people, including those in, who are heading up the sector, like the universities and the SCITs, they didn't want change, because they've just been through a really turbulent period, and they didn't feel like this was the right time to be reviewing things. So it doesn't surprise me that people are unhappy. But of course, adding a time frame for such a huge project like that, it is not going to go down particularly well.
In terms of sort of why it will impact on supply, is it just because I noticed in your story, it talked about how some providers obviously won't pass through this process and may need to pair up. So is it just because it will limit the number of suppliers and providers in the end, and that will mean less people can train?
That's a really good point. Yeah. So when Nick Brook spoke about it, he said it was extremely worrying that well-respected universities, for example, could withdraw from teacher training as a consequence of the proposals, which you might imagine could impact on supply. I think, yes, you're right. Because the requirements now going forward are going to be quite kind of stringent, some providers will not have the capacity to deliver them in their current form. So the expectation would be that they would then pair up maybe with another supplier or a series of other suppliers to create that capacity. But for some, that either won't be realistic, or it won't be how they envisage they want to deliver teacher training to these requirements that the DfE has set out. So that they may well feel that actually from now on they can't really justify not necessarily the cost of the change, but the kind of the effort and what would end up, what they'd end up with at the end, whether that's something that they would want to go forward with. So they might feel that actually they'll move away from teacher training and invest in something else. So that could potentially impact on supply down the road if we have lots of people kind of moving out of the sector. And we've already had, you might have seen Cambridge University has warned that it might well walk away because it doesn't feel like it agrees with the requirements that are being set. Mm. So there you go. We've already got some threats of that happening.
And in terms of the requirements being set, why is it that providers might walk away? Is it just the fact that, it feels like too much interference in what they're doing and what they've always done?
Possibly. Yeah, there's a few different reasons why people might be unhappy. For universities, the more kind of restrictions you place, it's not so much restrictions, but it's kind of more prescribed what they're going to have to do, how they're going to have to teach and train new teachers. The more prescription involved in that process, the more universities feel that their academic freedom is being restricted. And many people will argue that the work done at universities and indeed across the sector in teacher training, it's about kind of pushing boundaries, learning new things, engaging in academic research, so that teaching is something that will always develop and always change, just like many other professions. So it's lots of people will argue that there isn't a set kind of good criteria for training new teachers, that's likely to change and develop as our world kind of changes and develops. So to kind of have that prescription coming down from the top, which very much seems to be the focus of these proposals, universities will feel like that doesn't really fit with their ethos of how teaching and teacher training should be done. So yeah, that will be one issue that they might raise.
Just remind us what the DfE's of the original aims of this review were, because there's lots of theories out there about a kind of what their real aims are around, cost cutting to creating a cookie cutter that produces teachers in a kind of acceptable mold to the DfE. What did they originally say when they launched the review?
So from memory, I think the words they used were they wanted to create a more efficient and effective market. And I think at the time the review was launched, part of the problem that we had with reporting on it was that we didn't have a huge amount of detail of exactly what it was they wanted to do, what the changes would look like. So there was a lot of guessing going on, and some of our readers and listeners might remember at the time that it was launched, there were lots of threats of universities and other providers withdrawing from the market. But at that point, they had no idea what was going to be in the review. It was more a fear of what might be in the review that was troubling people. Mm-hmm. So the original aims, I mean, it's... Yeah, they were quite vague.
Very vague.
Yeah, however, yeah. You know, when they talked about creating an efficient market, you know, people may read into that, and they were correct to read into that, that it may look like a kind of different structure. And that's what the DfE said is going to happen.
Mm. Interesting. Thanks.
Amy, you've also reported on a story relating to a kind of different aspect of independence this week, which is the future of Online Academy Oak National. And it looks like it's now on track to get permanent government funding. Do you think that's going to compromise its ability to be as independent as it wants to be in the future?
Really interesting question. Yeah, so this was the big news that we revealed on Oak coming up, that it's going to receive, so it's going to continue to receive government funding for two more terms. Its funding was due to run out at the end of this academic year. And then there's this option under discussion to turn it into an what we understand to be an arm's length body from sort of Easter time. So I suppose in terms of Oak's independence, it's hard to know because we don't know a huge amount of detail about what that body might look like, what the structure would be, whether it would be something that the DfE had a kind of a great deal of say over, the delivery of the lessons, or whether it really would be more kind of distanced from that and fairly independent with just kind of a stream of government funding coming in. I suppose to date, Oak has always been funded through the government. So not a huge amount is going to change in that regard if the funding continues to come from central government. But I think it will be important to establish at some point, as I say, how much influence the government has over what the content should be that Oak produces and the way that it's used in schools as well. So we will see, but we do know or we understand that Oak hopes to remain optional, free and independent in whatever form it does take. So if it ends up being this arm's length body, we know from Oak's point of view, which probably won't surprise people, that it's keen to stay independent and kind of provide free content for the foreseeable. But we will see. There's an awful lot of questions that are yet to answer on this, and we'll be updating you as soon as we hear.
It's so interesting with Oak that it's something that obviously came about because of the pandemic as a sort of almost like a kind of stopgap online measure. And then now it really looks like it's going to become part of like the permanent infrastructure for schools and will be used on a regular basis.
Yeah, definitely. It was Oak. I mean, that was part of there was a bit of controversy when it was first launched about the processes that they went through in terms of contracting someone to run it, what it would look like. So it was all done very, very quickly as it needed to be done. So when it was established, it was certainly viewed as, you know, a quick, as you say, like a quick response, an emergency response to an emergency situation. I suppose like one of the things that we've learned over the course of the pandemic is how remote education can assist with teaching, even with children in school as well, you know, in terms of homework, teacher training, they've expanded to start to provide that too. Cover lessons, things like that, that we've learned about how obviously there have been drawbacks, but kind of how successful it's been in lots of ways. And we've learned what works and what doesn't. So I can see why the government would be considering investing it in the long term, so that they don't have to, you know, a couple of years down the line, start again with something else. You know, they've got this ready-made system. So we'll see kind of where they take it. But it is one of these things that when it was first launched, you know, we didn't necessarily see it going on forever, and that does seem to have changed.
Another really interesting story this week that has been really, really popular on our website, and obviously this is an on-running issue of the day, is around what's happening with exams, since exams were cancelled this year, and also looking at what's going to happen next year, given the lost learning that's occurred in the cohort that will be sitting GCSEs and A-levels next year. The incoming chair of Ofqual, the chief regulator, Jo Saxton, appeared before the Education Select Committee as a sort of pre-appointment hearing, and she has some interesting views around how exams might be moderated next year, didn't she, Catherine?
Yeah, so she, it was really interesting. I mean, she was speaking from a kind of personal preference capacity, not in terms of government policy, but she had a sort of gave some insights into sort of the way that exams could change next year. Obviously, year 10 and year 12 this year have suffered enormous learning losses as well. And so I think everyone's acknowledged that it can't completely go back to normal next year. And Gavin Williamson spoke about that a little while ago in the Commons as well. But one of the things that was planned for this year before exams were cancelled was the idea of possibly some kind of optionality or choice within the papers. And another idea was that students might get advance notice of what topics they would be tested on and what would come up in their paper to kind of guide their revision. And that was planned for 2021 or was being talked about before the exams were cancelled. And I think some of those things may be used for 2022. We still don't know with any certainty. But I thought it was interesting, obviously, you know, coming in to lead Ofqual, she was very much kind of against or seemed to be against the idea of changing papers or including optionality, just because it's very difficult, I think, when you introduce optionality, it can particularly disadvantage students who are already disadvantaged. So not being familiar with the format of the paper can be a real issue. And so she was talking about how it'd be much better if they had advance notice of topics and they could kind of have guide their revision in terms of what areas might come up. So it's interesting that that's her view on it. And it's something I've heard from sources in the exam sector before, that with optionality, it's a little bit of a dangerous thing to look into. It is an option that they could use, but it, because I mean, every year students get things wrong in papers anyway and answer the wrong questions or answer on the wrong text. And I think introducing sort of a different format into the paper so that they haven't really seen that before, they haven't seen a past paper that looks like that before, could be a bit risky. So that was an interesting insight that she gave about that. And then...
Did she give us any insights on, sorry, interrupted, but did she give us any insights on when we might actually know what's going to happen?
No, she didn't. And she was very clear that that it was just, she was speaking kind of in terms of what she personally might prefer. I know that obviously, you know, head teachers and schools are really desperate to know this. And, you know, time is definitely ticking on in terms of when they might get an update on plans for next year. We're really not that many working weeks away, as I think we said last week, from the start of the next academic year. But she didn't give any updates on that. But she did. Another thing she was talking about was that exams should go ahead. But she also said the pandemic is very unpredictable, and that, you know, that we can't say with any certainty that exams are going to go ahead next year, because we don't know what new variants might come up and we don't know really whether schools will be open then. So which I think is a sensible acknowledgement. But there were a range of things that that were touched on in that meeting. I think one of the other things that she spoke about was the kind of quality assurance for 2021. And the committee chair, Robert Halfen, he kind of pressed her quite a lot on this and asked several times what was happening for summer 2021 and was she concerned about grade inflation? And I think there's a real implication that he didn't feel that it was going to be taken seriously if there's grade inflation this year. And at one point he kind of accused her of thinking that everything was hunky-dory for summer 2021. But she sort of came back and said that there would be spot checks of schools' results and said that the quality assurance arrangements have been very rigorous. But that was a bit of a point of contention in the committee. And I think, you know, we've heard from other head teachers this week as well that grade inflation is very, very likely because of the system that's been put in place this year. And so one of the other things that we heard this week was also about COVID safety measures in schools, and that there is also going to be government confirmation that schools will be free to ditch bubbles, face masks and contact tracing measures from step 4 of its roadmap. John, is it right that schools can choose to keep bubbles?
It's an interesting question, because essentially the government has done two things in recent weeks. As you say, they basically almost as part of their national narrative about step 4 and moving out of COVID, they've basically relaxed restrictions massively, or proposing to. So as you say, bubbles coming to an end, social distancing no longer needed, masks no longer needed anywhere. But at the same time, a couple of weeks earlier, they put out a contingency framework, which basically told schools that they needed to have plans in place. And yeah, in this announcement, they have basically said part of that might mean that the bubbles are needed in your area, but this would be only in serious circumstances in terms of COVID control. So in a way, the government is doing what I think a lot of the sector wanted it to do last year, a little bit more proactively this year, which is it's made loads of noises about freedoms and relaxation this past week. And that's obviously proved controversial for some people. But there is underneath that a contingency framework at the moment that I'm sure will be updated between now and September. But that does say that there might need to be local decisions in your area. And that's literally a lot of things that you could imagine, really. But masks, bubbles, closing off to year groups if needed. So there is, I think, an acknowledgement that although they're saying that this is irreversible at a national level in terms of our kind of march to freedom or whatever, actually, there's a very real recognition that COVID might cause disruption again. And I think the interesting thing about that is, whereas last year, the DfE and the government nationally seemed to be really set against the idea of localised responses. And we had lots of stories about areas that were hard hit with the first sort of waves wanting to go to rotas and not being allowed to by the department. And the department even taking legal action to keep schools open in the run-up to Christmas, which is like one of the most surreal sort of episodes that we saw. In the latest framework, there is a kind of at this stage at least anyway, the suggestion that schools can make their own decisions or local health directors can make their own decisions about some aspects. But if we move to like an area-wide response, like a district wants to do something, then that'll need to be signed off by national government. So there's almost like two strands in a way. There's like, this is how we want to relax, but then this is how we want you to prepare for the worst as well.
One thing I noticed, sorry, Catherine, to jump in, was one of the responses I saw to the decision about giving schools flexibility over bubbles and stuff till the end of term is actually the NAHT School Leaders Union. As much as I'm sure schools enjoy some flexibility so that they can kind of adapt measures to suit whatever's happening in their area, the Deputy General Secretary did warn that shifting responsibility to schools for development and implementation of the contingency arrangements, that it must mean that the government doesn't kind of wash its hands of the problem, is what he said. And so I think there are questions to be asked about how much responsibility is being put on schools as well as flexibility, because at the end of the day, there does need to be, he argues that there does need to be backing from government to do what's necessary to kind of keep people safe. And we don't want to solely fall on school shoulders.
Mm-hmm. I think as well, there's something about how schools' reality and the national reality have jarred the whole way through this crisis. And I think it would be really difficult at the moment for schools to say, well, actually, we're going to keep bubbles in play. I think probably a lot will, just because of practicality. And it's only, I think they're talking about bubbles going once we get to step four, and you're literally practically at the end of the term then anyway. But I think it is difficult for schools to be able to sort of say, well, we think these measures are still needed and we want to recommend this when the country are watching a packed full Wembley Stadium and hearing the government saying it's time to live with the crisis, live with it like it's flu or live with it like it's another illness. I think it will put schools at the sharp end again come September in particular if what they think is needed jars with the kind of national narrative, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there seems to be a move, doesn't there, sort of across the board in terms of I can't think of the right sort of devolving responsibility for these things to other actors in society. So I heard Grant Shapps talking about being asked this morning about masks on public transport, and he said, "Well, I think sort of train companies could say that people should wear masks during busy periods." But it's kind of that same thing about sort of saying, "Well, we're not going to mandate on this anymore." Kind of you, head teacher, or you. Other kind of train operator, whatever, kind of need to make those decisions, which doesn't seem like a recipe for harmonious relations between head teachers and parents and various others.
I guess the thing I should have said at the outset is the idea of dropping bubbles and the need to self-isolate, I think is probably going to be well received by some of the sector at least, because the COVID levels we've seen this term as we've talked about in recent weeks, have just led to kind of escalating chaos in schools with, I think the latest figure said something like upwards of 600,000 pupils and more than one in 10 secondary school pupils off for COVID-related reasons. And that'll be the most part that they're in a bubble that starts because there's a positive case. And literally now, I think it's got to the point where literally everyone I speak to either through work or personally, they either their kid or they know someone within their school that bubbles closed. It almost seems like the disruption level is getting as bad as it was at other worst times in the crisis. The difference, I guess, is that whereas before, chaos in schools kind of went hand in hand with real concerns about hospitalizations and deaths, you've got the government now effectively sort of saying, well, we're happy that the vaccines have broken the link or weakened the link between that so we can push ahead with freedoms. But it does put schools in a really invidious position again, because they are basically being asked to relax COVID controls at a time when COVID's on the rise. Obviously, we'll have the break of the summer holiday, but it'll be really interesting come September. I think there's so much uncertainty still, even though I would say at least the DfE has set out quite a lot of what its thinking is now. Because a couple of weeks ago, you know, we were a month from the end of term and really we knew nothing. The school leaders were saying we need answers now. They have at least got some answers about what the government expects now or wants to happen.
Tell you what else, moving away from bubbles and schools' own contact tracing measures has raised some further questions, which I've been looking into this week, which have been really interesting, about how the government has said that now it'll be up to NHS Test and Trace to decide, to do contact tracing among children as well as among adults. So whereas before it was up to the schools to kind of figure out which children needed to self-isolate in the event of a positive case, or they certainly kind of helped with the process, now it's up to the NHS. So of course, one of the first questions that we saw raised by heads was, does that mean they're going to be calling up the children and saying, who were you with within a 9-day period, within 2 metres for 15 minutes or more? Can you imagine asking a reception child that? They'd be like, we had nice lunch today or something. You know, they wouldn't kind of know who they've been about playing with. So that was a question that we had to put to the DfE, because we sort of thought that's never going to work. And so the DfE did come back and they told me, okay, well, if it's younger children, then NHS will speak to their families. But as soon as you kind of start to think that through, that's not really that different, because if you speak to a family, they will necessarily need to ask the child who they've been spending time with, or they will need to go and ask the school. And so you essentially will come full circle to the point where schools are once again unofficially contact tracing, because of course the child's not going to be able to identify who they've been with all day, especially if they're younger, and the parents aren't in school, so they're not going to know. So that's where we are.
Amy did a brilliant thread on this that just literally spelled it out there, and you could see all literally school leaders sort of saying, yeah, this is exactly it. But I wonder whether it kind of points to an uncomfortable truth, really, which is that while ever kids are in school, it's going to be schools that have to do it, because they're the only ones with the knowledge. So whether they're leading it or responding to it, you know, whether it's them doing the contact tracing, or whether it's NHS staff doing it, or whether it's fielding a call from a parent, it's just a huge disruption that they're going to keep facing. And the government has made a big play on releasing the burden. But like from Amy's thread, it just feels like they're changing the burden and probably throwing in an element of chaos with it.
The burden will remain, but they're taking the credit away, is what it feels like. It's like schools will probably carry on having to do an awful lot of work in this area, and they won't be getting any thanks for it, because officially they're not doing anything. That's what it feels like to lots of school leaders. And I can't see it kind of being very sustainable, to be honest. But we know schools always step up when they need to do things like this. So I think inevitably it'll have to happen somehow. And that's what people fear it will look like at the moment.
This is, this is absolutely right that this is the kind of the story of the pandemic, isn't it? That that schools will have stepped up even when guidance has perhaps been a little bit vague or late. But it is, as you say, kind of another responsibility for schools. I think we might have rambled on long enough for this week, but obviously all these stories are available on our website, and we wish you all a very good weekend. Hopefully it's coming home, and see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Yes, bye.